The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service. And for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit G. Suggs Insurance. That's G as in go. Suggs, S-U-G-G-S, insurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's issue of Time Magazine, which is dated August 31/September 7, 2020, features an illustration of an American flag, except it's unfinished. The field of dark blue in the corner and the white stars is evident, and there are white stripes, but they don't go all the way to the bottom of the page of the cover. And then the red in between the white stripes looks like it's been woven, and there's a needle tucked into what's probably white fabric at the bottom of the farthest right stripe. A caption reads, "The New American Revolution, Visions of a Black Future that Fulfill a Nation's Promise." The artist of that cover illustration is Nika Jones, 23, and she's intended the unfinished American flag on the issue's cover to represent both a nation working to fulfill its ideals and black leaders looking up to a very optimistic future. And Nika Jones is embroidering this flag on canvas. The first article I've selected is entitled, "What Does Kindness Look Like?" Your efforts to help disabled people may not always have the intended effect. This is by Rebecca Tausig, and there is a photograph here of Tausig outside her home in Kansas City, Missouri, August 6. She's a young-looking blonde woman with dark eyes and wears pink lipstick. It looks like she's on the front porch of a house that's painted either beige or gray or white. We see a white door frame with window panes. And Tausig is wearing a dress, a black and white polka-dotted dress, and she's wearing black sneakers with white shoelaces, and she's sitting in a black wheelchair. "I am," and this is Tausig's words, Rebecca Tausig, "I am a magnet for kindness. Like the center of a black hole, my body attracts every good deed from across the universe to the foot of my wheelchair. I move through parking lots and malls, farmers markets and airports, bookstores and buffets, and people scramble to my aid. Okay, so there are plenty of people who don't seem to notice me, and some people who are actually repelled. They look down, pull their bag or their child closer to them, draw their legs up to their chest as I roll by. Yeah, it does not feel great, but it is the abundance of kindness that gets me all tangled. It is the fly that won't stop buzzing, won't hold still long enough for me to swat it, won't die. It is harmless, really. What damage can a tiny fly do? But then, why do I feel like tearing down the house every time I hear its familiar buzz? I have been paralyzed since receiving cancer treatments as a toddler, and I started using a wheelchair in first grade, so I've had 30 years to learn just how capable I am and just how often people assume I am helpless. As a culture, Americans are convinced that disability is something they have figured out. How could ableism exist when we've memorized the rules? Don't say the R word. Don't make fun. Disability does not define anyone. Try to be helpful and the rule that guides them all, be kind. I have seen so many people perform these creeds in one form or another, like the folks who try to do me a favor by keeping me separate from this disabled body of mine. All I see when I look at you is a beautiful woman. I do not even notice your wheelchair. It is meant as a kindness, but it feels like erasure. I think I understand how it happens. If you live in a community where disability is framed as tragic and inferior, then claiming not to see that so-called defect feels like a favor. We try to extract the disability from the person because we think disability's ugly, and the rules tell us this separation is nice. But do we attempt to extract thinness, Ivy League education, or wealth from a person? Of course not. We see these characteristics as inherently positive. Maybe individuals hold on to these features as part of their identity. Maybe they don't. But as a culture, we do not take it upon ourselves to graciously inform people that we see past their fit bodies, fancy diplomas, and piles of cash. There is no urgency to ignore thinness, no discomfort in recognizing education, no knee-jerk desire to erase wealth. But deep within, our cultural understanding of what it means to be a human with a body, we position disability below ability and at odds with health, beauty, wholeness, success, and happiness. Time and time again, people have become uncomfortable with or hostile to the stories I share about sitting on the receiving end of kindness. Maybe it's because so many of us claim kindness as one of the most important qualities a human can possess. Disrupting our understanding of kindness is a direct threat to our sense of self and understanding of the world around us. But as a veteran kindness magnet, I have found people's attempts to be kind can be anything from healing to humiliating, helpful to traumatic. At least 8 times a day, I yank and throw, pull and twist my wheelchair in and out of my beat-up 2007 Toyota Corolla, an ordeal that takes about 30 seconds. On this particular day, I'm assembling my chair when I hear a man yelling at me from across the parking lot. It's safe to assume he wants to help me, and I have decades of data to attest that he will not be able to make this routine even the slightest bit easier for me. I've got the body of the chair on the pavement by the driver's seat, and I'm reaching into the back seat for the first wheel. I am swift and strong. I am sure it must look difficult for someone who's never seen it, but I do not falter. The wheel's firmly in my grip when I catch a glimpse of the man running toward me. "Don't fall, don't fall," he shouts. "Oh, I'm fine," I say. "See?" I begin to slip the first wheel into position. The man sways on his feet, seemingly torn. I might look fine, but surely I am not. I assemble the second wheel, flip the chair to face me, and stand up to transfer. "Don't fall," he cries again. I hop into my seat and grab my bags. I am no longer trying to be pleasant. I have used my words and demonstrated through action, I'm fine. Why doesn't he see that? He rushes to open the door for me. I roll my eyes. The main messaging surrounding disabled people is that we are supposed to be nice to them. Or maybe it's close cousin, don't be mean. Regardless of our age, socioeconomic background, or education, we learn that disabled people need protection and assistance. If a disabled person's being made fun of, the kind person intervenes to say, "Stop that." Or better yet, punches the bully in the face and yells, "Scram," while the bully scuttles away. This is the power of the one-dimensional, deeply embedded, ableist script in our culture. Some bodies are victims, others are heroes. Like royal weddings or animals of different species cuddling, we cannot get enough of stories that involve kindness and disability. There's even a whole genre of news stories on the internet about cheerleaders and football stars asking disabled kids to the prom. High school football star becomes internet sensation after taking his disabled best friend to prom and leading her in a slow dance. Daily Mail. This student with a disability got asked to the prom in the sweetest way. BuzzFeed. And when pigs fly, girl asks boy with special needs to prom. NBC4 Columbus. In 2018, 15-year-old Clara Daly was on a flight when she heard the call, "Does anyone know American Sign Language?" She learned the flight included a deaf and blind passenger, Tim Cook, and the airline staff had no way to communicate with him. Daly had started learning sign language about the year before, and as she signed words into his palm, she became the conduit between Cook and the rest of his surroundings. There were at least four photos from their encounter posted on Facebook. In three of them, the camera focuses on Daly. Her blonde hair and glowing cheeks look almost otherworldly under the light pouring in from the windows. Cook's face is obscured. We see the back of his head, the side of his beard. In an interview with his local news station, Cook said he was used to isolation and thanked Daly for reaching out to him. This detail added a sprinkling of heartbreak to the story and remained unexamined. The title of the article was not "Deaf and Blind Man Sheds Light on Social Exclusion for Disabled Communities." The article did not include a whiff of interest in solving the problem of disability stigma or social ostracism, or even how to make airplanes more accessible for disabled folks. Instead, the events were transformed into a gooey celebration of the 45 minutes when one pretty girl talked with one disabled man so its readers could get the feeling of being wrapped in a hug. I get it. The world's dark and scary, and we need more feel-good stories. These articles did not try to fix the problem of ableism, but are they really so bad? Isn't any form of being there for another person worth celebrating? Well, here is the problem. We have ignored the perspectives, stories, and voices of disabled people for so long that their actual needs, feelings, and experiences are hardly acknowledged. We look through the eyes of non-disabled people so regularly, we forget to ask even one of the many questions hovering around the disabled recipients of help. Did you want anyone's help? Was it even helpful? What needs did you have that remained ignored or misunderstood? What could be put into place so that you are not forced to be dependent on the kindness of a stranger who may or may not be there next time? Did you know you were being photographed? Did you want those images shared? How did this experience feel to you? How many times have you been put in this position before? I am about 17, and my boyfriend Sam and I are leaders for a weekend youth group trip. We are scheduled to walk through some touristy caves that are clearly inaccessible. And as the group lines up, I mention I'll meet them by the exit. "Beck, I'll carry you," Sam says. Sam carries me a lot, and usually it's welcome and easy, but this time I'm tired. Also, I do not care about the caves. "Sam, it's like a mile long in there," I say. "Don't be ridiculous." "Ah, that's nothing," he says, flexing his biceps like a superhero. "No, really, I'm tapping out of this one," I say. "Would you please just let me carry you?" Sam asks loudly. Other people are listening now. "I really don't want to," I mumble. Sam kneels in front of me. "Please let me carry you," he says, quietly now. "Aw," a few girls close behind us say. Why do I say yes? Who am I trying to please? What good do I think this will do? 100 feet in, I know I've made a mistake. My chest and cheek rest against Sam's dampening back, and my arms and neck start to ache. As we reach a tight corner, Sam bends down, and I see a flash behind us. I turn to see a girl winding her disposable camera. She continues to take pictures of Sam carrying me through the cave throughout the tour, more interested in the performance of hero and damsel than the caves themselves. If this had taken place today, would we have become another viral internet story? I can see it now. Brave boy carries disabled girl through cave. There's hope for humankind after all. With each step, I wonder whether my shoulders will pop out of their sockets. I feel like a deformity growing off Sam's back. When we finally make it to the other side of the cave, we have to wait for my chair to arrive. Sam helps me prop myself against a wall, as person after person congratulates him. "Dude, that was incredible," they say. "I can't believe you carried her the whole way." Sam does not make a big deal of it. Even so, I do not want him to touch me. I'm running errands one afternoon wearing my favorite steel-toe logging boots with red laces. They are heavy and big and make me feel rugged and powerful. I pull up to the car repair shop and see a man watching me pull my chair out of my car and put it together on the pavement. This setup ends with my feeling small, so regularly. My prickles spike before I even process the emotions. I will myself to throw my chair together at turbo speed before he can read me as desperate and flailing. Then I hear him. Such a simple, casual sentence. "Looks like you've got this," he says. I look up. "Yep," I say. "I really do." Now, Tausig's the author of Sitting Pretty, The View from My Ordinary, Resilient, Disabled Body, from which this essay was adapted and which I did abridge. This is under the heading Health, When COVID Doesn't Go Away. For some patients, the disease lingers for months. Scientists are studying the magnitude of the problem and how to respond. By Jamie Ducharme. There's a photo here at the beginning of this article. It shows a woman, a young woman, sitting in bed with a boy, a little boy, a blonde boy, and the woman has darker blondish brown hair. In between them, on the comforter that covers them both, are two kittens, blue-eyed and green-eyed kittens. Kayla Brim laughed when she learned it could take 10 days to get her COVID-19 test results back. I thought, okay, well, within 10 days I should be fine, she remembers. That was July 2. More than a month later, Brim is still far from fine. Before the pandemic, the 28-year-old from Caldwell, Idaho, juggled homeschooling her two kids with her work as a makeup artist. She was supposed to open her own salon in July. Now she suffers daily from shortness of breath, exhaustion, excruciating headaches, brain fog, neuropathy, high blood pressure, and loss of taste and smell. She feels like a little old lady, completely knocked out by simple tasks like making lunch for her children. She's working just enough to help pay the bills and the lease on her empty salon, but she has no idea when she'll be able to work full-time again, and no idea how she and her husband will manage financially if she cannot. Half my day is spent trying to sleep, and the other half of it is trying to pretend I'm okay. And I don't know when I'll be okay, Brim says. This is long haul, COVID-19. Even young, healthy people can become long haulers, as many call themselves, left unable to work, lead a normal life, or some days get out of bed. The consequences for each individual can be devastating, and at scale, they are staggering. Over time, long-haul coronavirus may force hundreds of thousands of people out of work and into doctor's offices, shouldering the double burden of lost wages and hefty medical bills for the indeterminate future. To treat them, the healthcare system may have to stretch already thin resources to the breaking point. It is going to be an impending tsunami of patients on top of all the usual chronic care we do, says Dr. Zijun Chen, medical director of the Center for Post-COVID Care at New York City's Mount Sinai Health System, one of the country's only clinics devoted to caring for patients in the aftermath of coronavirus infection. At some point, it becomes very unsustainable, meaning the system will collapse. When most people think of COVID-19, they imagine two possibilities: a flu-like illness that clears on its own, or a life-threatening condition that requires ventilation and a hospital stay. It is not hard to see how the latter scenario leads to long-term damage. Mechanical ventilation is incredibly hard on the lungs, and days or weeks spent sedated in a hospital bed can sap physical and mental strength. In a small study published in 2011, nearly all the participants who needed intensive treatment for a severe lung injury reported decreased physical ability and quality of life 5 years after leaving the hospital. Some took years to return to work. Hospitalized coronavirus patients may face a similar fate. But with COVID-19, it is not just the sickest who face a long road back. A July 24 report from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, found out that of about 300 non-hospitalized but symptomatic COVID-19 patients, 35% were still experiencing symptoms like coughing, shortness of breath, and fatigue, up to 3 weeks after diagnosis. By contrast, more than 90% of non-hospitalized influenza patients fully recover within 2 weeks. Recovery from COVID-19 can be a drawn-out process for patients of all ages, genders, and prior levels of health, potentially leading to prolonged absence from work, studies, or other activities, the report noted. The CDC's surveyors only checked up on people a few weeks after they tested positive for coronavirus, but emerging evidence suggests a large subset of patients are sick for months, not just weeks, on end. Dr. Michael Peluso, who's studying long-term COVID-19 outcomes at the University of California, San Francisco, says about 20% of his research participants are still sick 1 to 4 months after diagnosis. The implications of that problem are enormous. Even if 10% of the more than 5 million and counting confirmed COVID-19 patients in the U.S. suffer symptoms that last this long, 500,000 people are already or could soon become ill for the foreseeable future. When Mount Sinai opened its Center for Post-COVID Care in May, the hospital advertised it as the first in the country. Since then, a handful of others have opened, including Colorado, Indiana, and Illinois. Mount Sinai's clinic was modeled after the practice the hospital opened to treat survivors of the 9/11 terrorist attacks. "It's very similar. It's a new group, and they need special care," Chen says. "The biggest difference," he says, "is the size of the group. Significantly more people have survived COVID-19 than were directly affected by 9/11. Mount Sinai's only scratched the surface of that demand, treating about 300 people so far. The wait time for new patients extends into October. The challenge for doctors like Chen is nobody really knows why long-haul COVID-19 happens, let alone how to treat it. Other viral diseases with long-term symptoms like HIV/AIDS offer some clues, but every day in the clinic is essentially uncharted territory. One hypothesis is the virus persists in the body in some form, causing continuing problems. Another is coronavirus pushes the immune system into overdrive and it stays revving even after the acute infection passes. But at this point, it's not clear which theory, if either, is right, or why certain patients recover in days and others suffer for months, Peluso says. Plus, just as there's huge variation in acute COVID-19 symptoms, not all long-term patients have the same issues. A researcher from the Indiana University School of Medicine in July surveyed 1,500 long haulers from Survivor Corps, an online COVID-19 support group. They reported almost 100 distinct symptoms, from anxiety and fatigue to muscle cramps and breathing problems. A JAMA cardiology study published in July suggested many recently recovered patients have lingering heart abnormalities, with inflammation the most common. Some long-term COVID-19 patients have abnormal test results or damage to a specific organ, giving doctors clues as to how they should be treated. But for others, there is no obvious reason for their suffering, making treatment an educated guessing game. We do not know why they still have symptoms. We do not know if our techniques are working, Chen says. We do not know if they're going to get back to 100% or 90% or 80%. With little evidence, some doctors turn coronavirus long haulers away or try to convince them their symptoms are psychological. Marcus Tomoff, a 28-year-old in Tampa, who's in his second month of debilitating fatigue, back and chest pain, nausea and anxiety after a bout of coronavirus, says he has not been taken seriously by friends or even doctors. Several times I've cried in front of my doctors and they say, "You need to deal with this. You are young," he says. The haphazard testing system in the U.S. has further complicated patients' searches for care. Mount Sinai's post-COVID center, for example, accepts only patients who have tested positive for COVID-19 or its antibodies, and Chen fears potential patients who cannot get tested or get false negative results may be falling through the cracks. The best he can do right now is refer them to specialists and hope they find a doctor who can help. For 46-year-old Andrea Cereza, getting better is a full-time job, minus the paycheck. Cereza had to leave her job managing a New Jersey dental office after she got sick in mid-April with what she and her doctors believe was COVID-19. She tested negative for the virus and its antibodies, but her doctors think they were false negatives. More than 100 days later, she's in regular contact with her primary care physician, an integrative care doctor, and a rotating cast of specialists who she hopes can treat her lingering gastrointestinal problems, hearing and vision issues, weight and hair loss, heart palpitations, migraines, brain fog, neuropathy, fatigue, nausea, and anxiety. She finally got into a post-COVID program after weeks of waiting, but she's mostly been left to cobble together her own care team. Cereza has paid for her own health insurance through the federal COBRA program since she stopped working, which has put her in a precarious financial state. "I have a stack of bills, and I just am starting to open them now," she says. "I am definitely at this point going to be in the hole thousands of dollars. I am collecting unemployment. I know I'm going to have to go on disability." Even then, she says, it may not be enough to pay her bills. "There may soon be a lot of patients like Cereza," says Dr. Bhakti Patel, a pulmonologist at University of Chicago Medicine, who studies the long-term effects of critical care. Patel says patients with long-term issues after surviving coronavirus may face a number of obstacles. Patients who remain too sick to return to work or who are unemployed because of the economic climate may lose employer-sponsored health insurance at the moment they need it most. Younger patients who do not qualify for Medicare but need public insurance may be funneled toward Medicaid, which Patel says is already overstretched. The services long-haul coronavirus patients may need, like physical therapy and mental health care, can be difficult to access, especially via public insurance networks like Medicaid, Patel says. That bottleneck will only get worse if more people need public aid. Without clear answers about what happens next, all doctors can offer the public is yet another plea to take coronavirus seriously, because right now the only surefire way not to become a long hauler is to not get COVID-19 at all. That does not help people like Sarasa, though. After more than 100 days of feeling sick, she says she's still baffled this happened to her. An active and healthy woman who's been a vegan for decades. She stayed home all April, except for a couple trips to the grocery store, and still had her life destroyed by the virus. She cannot work, sing in her band, or plan her wedding after getting engaged a few weeks before the pandemic hit. She tries to comfort herself by thinking about ways it could be worse. It could be cancer, but the truth is things are bad. You try to be hopeful and think somehow, miraculously, you're going to be better, and it does not happen, she says. I cannot imagine living like this for another day, let alone the rest of my life. At this point, no one knows if she will have to. And that article was again slightly abbreviated. Under the heading World After the Explosion, abandoned by the government that left a bomb on their doorstep, Beirut tries to summon the energy for change. This is by Carl Vick with some photographs by Miriam Boulos for Time. The photograph on the first page of this article is of a young woman. She's wearing pink slacks and a white tank top. She's standing in front of a window, but there's no window there. It's just a bunch of cracked plaster with an opening to what appears to be a shipyard beyond some rubble in the street outside her non-window. It's Noor Saliba, 27, in her apartment in the Mar Mikhail neighborhood, August 6, 2 days after the explosion destroyed Beirut's port, which is visible through her blown-out window. I only lost my home. I am one of the lucky ones who still have their family and friends by their side, she says. We're all traumatized, but we are also burnt out. For 3 decades, the most reliable feature of Lebanon's government was its relentless decline. Here was a country so brazenly corrupt, the World Bank abandoned its usual diplomatic language in 2015, declaring it increasingly governed by bribery and nepotism practices, failing to deliver basic human services. Among ordinary people, the lived reality of Lebanese politics produced a gall that rose like the stench of the garbage that's accumulated on the capital's streets because officials cannot figure out where to put it. In October, the announcement of higher taxes triggered gigantic daily protests across the country, but they have not yet led to any substantial change. The question now is whether the catastrophic explosion of August 4, which wiped away more than 220 lives and the homes of 300,000 people in Beirut, will ultimately take down Lebanon's unique political system. The country's constitution, which guarantees government positions to 18 separate religious sects, was intended to balance the interests and needs of a diverse cosmopolitan nation. In reality, it provides semi-permanent employment for self-dealing elites in political parties that look after themselves rather than a greater good, which is how 2,750 metric tons of ammonium nitrate had languished since 2013 in a port warehouse in the center of a city of 2.4 million people. We've been living next to an atomic bomb for 6 years. We stroll around, we walk by it, but we know nothing about it, says resident Jad Estefan, of what produced one of the largest man-made non-nuclear explosions in global history. How can the people in charge be this conscienceless? For a week after the blast, photographer Miriam Boulos moved through the wreckage of her native city, documenting an aftermath nearly as extraordinary as the explosion. Soldiers and police standing idle while ordinary people bent to the task of clearing debris. They carry guns, says Bulos. They don't help with anything. As she photographed, she also asked questions. It's important we tell our own stories, she says. At the end of the day, the country is people. Citizens complain about their government in every nation, but few have better cause than the Lebanese. In a country that made its national symbol a tree, the Lebanese people had to put out fires that were devastating our forests because our government was unable to do its job, Noor Salibah told Bulos, recalling a series of forest fires last October. It was the month that daily demonstrations erupted in the capital. Protesters demanded an end to corruption and a new constitution. The pandemic was still months away, but misrule had already sent the country's economy into free fall, and almost half the 6.8 million residents, including 1.5 million Syrian refugees, lived in poverty. After 2 weeks of protests in October, Prime Minister Saad Hariri resigned. His replacement stepped down August 10 after the protests, which had dwindled during the pandemic, resumed with a seething new anger. The explosion it cannot not define us in a way, says Bulos. Of course it is a turning point. Riyad Hussein al-Hussein was buying vegetables in the city's Mar Mikhail neighborhood when he was knocked to the ground by the blast wave. He noticed he was bleeding from his head. Someone came to help him. He used a cotton compress and pressed on my wounds for what seemed like a long time. He said that I had to endure the pain, and I endured. That lasted about 20 minutes. I really thought I was dying. I held my Savior's hand while he was helping me, and I asked him to say goodbyes to my family, he says. Nothing binds people to one another like a trauma endured together. The explosion devastated three neighborhoods, a poor district east of the port, an enclave of Armenian Christians, and a gentrifying zone of older residents and young artsy people. But with a damage radius of 6 miles, the entire city came apart, and then it came together. Sharif Kanaan told Bulos he was at home when he heard the explosion. My mom, my brother, and I ran toward each other very scared. A few seconds later, the whole building started shaking like crazy, and the massive blast hit us, he says. The look in their eyes will forever haunt me. We really thought we were going to die. He left the apartment and sprinted first to the home of his uncle, where everyone was okay. From there, he ran from hospital to hospital, looking for people to help. He found them everywhere. He held a compress to a wounded nurse outside a destroyed hospital, then cut his hand lifting a metal pole out of the road. He helped an old man struggling with a bandage and took off his shirt for a woman carrying two babies. Back at the ruined hospital, he saw a woman with a terrible wound on her face. Her name was Angelique. I could not quite get her family name at first because of her numb lips, he says. Kanaan took her phone, reassuring relatives who were calling constantly. In the mayhem, an ambulance appeared. He bundled Angelique into a scene that would stay with him. On a stretcher was a young girl named Alexandra, struggling to breathe, her grandpa at the back, a lady doctor next to him, insufflating Alexandra, her dad with a broken left cheekbone. Angelique next to him, myself, a wounded old lady in front of me, a wounded old man next to her behind the driver, and a rescuer, I believe, Kanaan says. Alexandra would not survive. It was 6 days after the blast that Prime Minister Hassan Diab resigned, saying he wanted to stand with the people. The next day, 1 week to the minute after the explosion, citizens gathered in the wreckage of their capital. At 6:08 p.m., what moved through the air was not a blast wave, but the Muslim call to prayer and the peal of church bells. Let us hope this catastrophe does not destroy us even further, but rather gives us a much-needed strength, says Estefan. Because this is our last chance, we must change today or never. Here is one of the photos. A city upended. The blast estimated at 1/10 the size of the atomic explosion at Hiroshima sent a wave of destruction 6 miles across a city already reeling from shortages of food, water, and electricity. Cleanup efforts have been left to volunteers, with authorities all but invisible. It's a smashed white sedan. It's smashed under the wreckage of tree limbs and crumpled roofing from buildings and a chain-link fence that's falling down around it, and the dead leaves of the tree framing it. Now, here's some more photographs. I won't describe them all. There are about a dozen. Okay, on the bottom, in the right corner, a young woman dressed in black with long, dark hair. She has on black jeans and a black tank top, and she's standing next to a young man wearing khaki denims, it looks like, or khaki cargo pants. He's got a dark blue shirt on. He's holding a red hard hat, helmet-type thing. He has dark curly hair and a mustache and beard. It was Angelique Sabunjian was hit by glass at a coffee shop in the Gamesa area, and Sharif Kanan found her in bad shape at an overwhelmed hospital and stayed by her side until he was confident she was in good hands. And this young woman does have some mashed-up-looking scrapes and bruises on her face under and over her right eye. Then next to that picture to the left, it's called A Cactus and Broken Windows. It looks surreal. There's a little cactus with red cactus flowers poking itself out of a broken window. It's glass with shards that are almost symmetrical. All of them are almost rectangular. And it looks as if they didn't really break. They just shattered in place. There are only a few shards out of place, and that little cactus is poking itself up through that mess. And then one final photo, there are two older people. There's an old guy sitting in a chair in the foreground. He's wearing blue jeans and a blue casual shirt, and an older woman sitting in the background. They may be sitting at a kitchen or dining room table, and she has white hair, so does he, and she's wearing a blue print dress. She's sitting on a bright green chair. Behind her are bright blue shutters that are framing a window, and the table between them, which might be a dining room or a patio, it's indistinguishable, holds a pink cage. I wonder if it's going to tell us what that is. It's Joseph Safir and his sister Mona. His reflex on August 4 was to save his grandchildren, the reasons he came back years ago from France, and the children were uninjured. Here's the page entitled For the Record. The current data presents an untenable situation. University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill administrators in an August 17 letter to students saying the school would cancel in-person instruction for undergraduates after 130 students tested positive for COVID-19 within 1 week of the start of classes. I am going to take a very good look at it. Donald Trump, U.S. President, raising the possibility August 15 of a pardon for former NSA contractor Edward Snowden. Trump had previously called Snowden a spy who should be executed. Now here's a red and white sketch of a ship. It looks like a cargo ship. It has lots of strange things sitting on its deck, big container-type things. 1.116 million, the number of barrels of Venezuela-bound petroleum confiscated by U.S. authorities in the largest ever seizure of fuel from Iran, according to a Justice Department announcement, August 14. I will never give up. Abdullahi Mohammed Noor, Somali parliament member and owner of the Elite Hotel in Mogadishu, pledging to continue investing in the country in an August 16 tweet. Noor was rescued from the hotel following a terrorist attack by al-Shabaab militants. He simply cannot be who we need him to be for us. It is what it is. Michelle Obama, former U.S. First Lady, speaking about President Donald Trump and echoing his earlier statement about U.S. COVID-19 deaths in a keynote address on the first night of the virtual Democratic National Convention, August 17. Before any evidence, they just claimed and presumed, "I'm guilty." Jimmy Lai, or Lai, it's L-A-I. Hong Kong media mogul in an August 14 interview. Lai was arrested earlier in the month under the territory's restrictive new national security law. 130 degrees Fahrenheit, observed temperature in California's Death Valley, August 16. If officially verified, it would be the hottest temperature recorded anywhere on Earth since 1913. Good news of the week. Officials at the National Zoo in Washington, D.C. confirmed August 17, giant panda Mei Zhang was pregnant. Viewership on the zoo's panda cam increased by 800%. Time off music, concerts, facing the music again with cautious enthusiasm by Capt Moon Taipei. When Dami Lee bought a ticket to attend the first concert of Eric Chu's 2020 How Have You Been tour in Taipei, August 8, she knew she would have to wear a mask upon entry. What she did not know was that she would win a lottery that got her a second one. A pink medical mask signed by the Mando Pop singer-songwriter who gave it to her on stage, a memento not just of Lee's first concert, but also of how fundamentally COVID-19 has changed public life. At that night, the 10,000-plus concert-goers at the Taipei Arena experienced what few have felt in nearly half a year, the energy of a packed house, singing along with a beloved artist's songs, that a concert of this size, larger than any other reported on since social distancing measures began, was taking place in Taiwan, is a testament to the self-governing island's strong response to the coronavirus. Heading into the show, Taiwan, which has a population of more than 23 million, had recorded 479 cases of COVID-19 and 7 deaths. In June, after no locally transmitted cases had been recorded for 8 weeks, restrictions were lifted on large gatherings, including performances. Despite the low transmission rate, the concert was marked by strict disease prevention measures. Fans who had come to see the 25-year-old singer, best known for his soulful ballads, made their way through various stations set up for safety protocols. Apart from masks and temperature checks, all attendees needed to provide an ID card or a special code to help facilitate contact tracing should the need arise. When large-scale indoor concerts will return elsewhere hinges on the arrival of a vaccine and remains as uncertain as the trajectory of the pandemic itself. While nations experiment with the new normal for live music, the UK tested a socially distanced outdoor venue with pods of up to 5. Chu's concert signaled that in Taiwan, the old normal might return sooner. Chu, for one, tells Time he sorely missed interacting with fans. "I love that during the chorus, I'll just be like, Da, Zha, Yi Ki Chang, Mandarin for let's sing together and then everyone joins in." When Lee accepted the autographed mask from Chu, her eyes matched the beam hidden behind her face covering. I am not going to wear it, she said later. I'll carefully keep it safe. This is called The View, Sports, Football's Losing Plan by Sean Gregory. More than any other major team sport, college football is fueled by state identity and tribal customs. On any given fall Saturday, just visit the elaborate tailgates in places like State College, Pennsylvania, College Station, Texas, or The Grove, some 10 acres planted in the center of the University of Mississippi, which can host more than 50,000 revelers. The sport powers local economies, and that business won't be given up easily. Even during a health crisis in which more than 170,000 people in the U.S. have died, decision makers are desperately trying to hold on to ingrained cultural traditions while protecting a multi-billion dollar athletic industrial complex baked into higher education. But college football lacks cohesive national leadership. Instead, each Power Five football conference has latitude to look after its bottom line at the expense of unpaid players who've put their health at great risk. Players have already experienced COVID-19 outbreaks at Clemson, Kansas State, Rutgers, and Oklahoma. Now left to their own devices, the Pac-12 and Big Ten conferences, with schools like Stanford, UCLA, Northwestern, and Maryland in coastal and upper Midwest lean blue states, decided to cancel their fall college football seasons. Meanwhile, schools in the Southeastern, Big 12, and Atlantic Coast conferences, which are mostly in the red states that reopened early and saw a subsequent rise in COVID-19 cases, are saying they are still going to play football. Not that everyone falls into neat camps. There's dissension and mixed messaging within conferences and at individual universities as well. Ohio State University quarterback Justin Fields has started a petition to reinstate the season, and it's already garnered more than 275,000 signatures. The University of Alabama, whose football team brought in $94.6 million in revenue during the 2019 academic year, is among the schools trying to give the most unsocial distanced of sports a go. But its fans cannot seem to get out of their own way. On August 16, a large group of people in Tuscaloosa, home of the Crimson Tide, were spotted lined up, bunched together, unmasked, outside a bar. The school's athletic director took to Twitter to tusk the youthful-looking patrons. "Who wants college sports? Obviously not these people," wrote Alabama AD Greg Byrne. And August 17, the University of North Carolina announced that after 130 students tested positive for COVID-19, the school was reverting to remote instruction. A few hours later, the school's athletic department released a statement saying workouts and practices would continue. A campus was deemed unsafe for students, but student athletes would apparently be just fine. College football's lost season carries devastating consequences. The sport often funds entire athletic departments. At Alabama, football accounts for 77% of team revenues, according to federal data. Canceling football could cause schools to cut athletic opportunities in other sports. Stanford, for example, had already dropped 11 sports like fencing and field hockey in early July, citing harsh financial realities of COVID-19. Expect more such decisions around the country. Sadly, Americans can only blame themselves and their leaders for the disarray. States push too fast to reopen, testing so backed up as to be virtually useless. Americans continue to die at alarming rates. While pro sports facilities sit empty, Texas A&M University still expects to fill its 100,000-plus seat stadium to 30% capacity, despite the state's hitting 10,000 COVID-19 deaths recently, but a lot can happen between now and the season opener that will supposedly take place in a few weeks. On August 16, the NCAA's top medical doctor said, without testing improvements, there's no way we can go forward with sports. It was an astute philosopher, Washington Nationals pitcher Sean Doolittle, who said in July, sports are like the reward of a functioning society. For college football, the sins of spring and summer will deliver a quiet fall. It was never going to be easy to get a kickoff, but America's attempt to have a college football season in the midst of a global pandemic is looking more and more like a hopeless Hail Mary. Like so much else in America's COVID-19 moment, the effort to get players on the field is messy, is divisive, and reflects poorly on leaders at the top. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine's available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have questions or comments, call us at 919-832-5138. The number again, 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.